Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to today's Football Times, our 1980s odyssey that we had. We did talk about the need and the requirements, and you know, there was no way we weren't going to do it. Conversations about the Hillsborough disaster. We did one on Bradford. We did one on Heysel. And with the added poignancy of the 35th anniversary, which is just amazing to think it's been so long. For something for me, feels like yesterday still, that stays with me every day. This is, you know, we don't know how many of these conversations we'll do. We don't know how long they'll be. They might be 5 minutes, 10 minutes. They might be an hour or so. They'll just go where they go. And the first guest is the wonderful Dr. Anne. Anne, thank you so much for joining me for this. Sociologist specialising in psychosocial aspects of major incidents, emergency planning and disaster management. Anne, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure and a privilege to talk with you, Stephen. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, no, it's brilliant. I mean, I've put my hands up here. Me and Anne have crossed paths at Anfield a couple of times now, and we've just hit it off, you know, fantastically from word go. One of those people that you're lucky enough to feel a, you know, proper connection with, and Anne's just brilliant. And yeah, so delighted that she's joining us. Anne, we'll just go straight into it. I've come up with a rough sketch of how we should do these, and you know, who were you on the morning of April the 15th, 1989?
Yeah, it's a good place to start. Well, April the 15th, 1989, that sunny morning, I was 25. I had just completed my studies in sociology at Liverpool University. I'd just finished a PhD 1 month before the disaster, actually, and I was a COP season ticket holder. And in terms of a little bit of background to that, I guess, I ought to explain, because I haven't got a Liverpool accent, as well as being a tomboy and fascinated into football from a very early age, I became a Liverpool fan in 1974. I was born in North London, so by birth, I ought to be either an Arsenal or a Spurs fan in terms of geography, but I often say that's exactly why I'm a Liverpool fan. So in 1974, when Liverpool beat Newcastle in the FA Cup, I had a moment of conversion and I said to my brother, I'm going to start supporting Liverpool, and I never looked back. But I think for me, being a Liverpool fan, and this I think becomes relevant for understanding, making sense of Hillsborough and everything after too, is and has always been about more than the football. So in the 1970s, when I was in secondary school, I just fell in love with the city of Liverpool. Even though I hadn't yet been there, it was a time of the Liver Birds, for anyone who remembers on television. I was a second-generation Beatles convert. And the very first time I went up to Liverpool, in fact, visit my brother who was up studying at the university there, and going to my first match, I just felt like I'd arrived, that I was home. And every time I go back to Liverpool now since, I feel like that. So it was a no-brainer for me. I selected Liverpool as my place of study for university. I went there in 1981. I'd spent by then, up till 1989, all my time studying sociology and then going to match. And so Liverpool and football was kind of coming home for me. Yeah, so I had a season ticket all the way through the 1980s, which was a great and amazing time to be a Liverpool fan. And as it still is, a great time. And I went to all the home games, and as you'll appreciate, Stephen, quite a few trips to Wembley in those days.
Yes.
I hadn't been to many, or I think really any other away games. So actually, the away game at Hillsborough was my first away game, really. Yeah.
So many kind of like striking tones there. You know, my first game was 77. You know, my dad took me along to watch, it was Kevin Keegan's return in Hamburg shirt, the European Super Cup game. And obviously didn't become a regular at such a tender age, but yeah, occasional visits to Anfield from there, and then yeah, escalated through the '80s as yeah, I could do it myself, even when I wasn't meant to. Yeah, a couple of bus trips, just going out to see my mates. You know, tip back 5 hours later, having been to the football. Yeah, knowing what was happening on Match of the Day later that night. was sometimes a giveaway, shall we say, of where I'd been for the afternoon.
Brilliant.
But the afternoon of April the 15th, Dan, you've a few bullet points that you want to flash up for us. This part of the podcast, you know, it's never going to be anything other than difficult and, you know, highly sensitive. But this is, you know, your open forum to say what you want to say about the afternoon.
Oh, thank you. Well, I've told my story quite a few times and been through it quite a few times. And although it's never easy, you do tend to select, well, I tend to select certain things, which I think is part of keeping it. What I'm doing now in talking to you is I'm kind of opening up a mental box and taking out some experiences and then I'm kind of putting them back in and I'm filtering through what's going to be of interest, I hope, to you or relevant to our conversation, etc. And I think that's what happens with telling this kind of story. But I guess I'd start by saying I got my ticket for the FA Cup semi-final the night before, which is relevant to understanding the impact of disaster on everyone, really, in my life, because my family didn't know that. I was with my family the week before. We had a family gathering for a birthday, and I was telling my family I was trying to get a ticket, but I only got my ticket the night before through a friend of a friend. And then, so I was really madly excited, as you can imagine, even now going into it. I'm remembering the sick excitement that you always get on a match day and a special day like that. I got there. I was traveling with a friend. We got to Sheffield. We got a train before the specials train, if you remember those trains in those days, because I remember I always had this anxiety. I still do, about getting to places on time and not being late and things like that. So we actually got to Sheffield quite early in the morning, and we went round the town, etc. And we, in fact, bumped into another friend who I jumped on at the railway station just to surprise him and shock him. And we arranged to meet up later. He had a ticket for the seated area, and we said, all right. When we actually got to the ground, we split up and said, all right, we'll meet you after the match. And then we went early into the we just had a ticket. Our tickets were standing, but it wasn't clear where. And that was one of the things identified, of course, as the causal factor of the disaster. We just knew we were standing at the Leppings Lane end of the ground. So we queued up, went through turnstiles, and we got into the ground at about 2:15. And I think relevant to telling my story, and many others may relate to this, there are certain facts in an experience like that, not least one where you end up giving statements to the police and others, where certain facts become crystal clear in your mind. So I know it was 2:15, and that was in my statement. And we went down the tunnel, and I hadn't been to Hillsborough before. So when you went through the turnstile, of course, many of us didn't know where to go. You just followed everybody else. We went down the infamous tunnel into one of the two middle pens. So I was in pen three, as it was described. The pens were divided into, there were four pens across that standing area at the Leppings Lane end of the ground where the Liverpool fans were. And when we went into, when we went down the tunnel and into the pens, I wanted to go at the front, and my friend said, no, you get the crushing at the front, so we'll go at the back, a decision that may well have saved our lives. So we were right at the back, actually, although it isn't a big area. It wasn't a big area between the front and the back of those pens, but we were at the back of there. And then obviously over the next hour or so, the crush built up, as everybody knows. And my story is that I was one of the match started. I couldn't see anything. But I was getting panicky a bit with the crush, but thinking it was just me, I'm just being girly and all of that. And you kind of switch off and try and just, stay okay. But I was actually one of the first people, I think, pretty early on to be pulled out of the crush at the back, because I was either lost consciousness or losing consciousness. And somebody, another fan, of course, that pulled me up from the back. And I still can never get my head around, Steve, and I've told this story many times before, and when I'm telling it to an audience, I kind of look up at the ceiling above me and say, look, you know, where they pulled me up from, there, you know, it was kind of as high as this ceiling. There's a superhuman power that sometimes comes in when you're rescuing somebody or even being rescued. And I don't know to this day how it happened, but those fans who pulled people like me out did a phenomenal job. So I ended up being pulled out and spending the rest of the time while I was still at the ground, turning around, then facing the front and seeing everything that unfolded. And when I did actually come out of the ground, which was at about 4:45, another time that sticks in my memory, because I remember looking at my watch and thinking, this is the time normally when, you know, you're coming out of the ground. In those days, we'd always won the match and everybody was happy and joyful, but obviously it was a bit It was very different then. The match hadn't happened. But I often think, and again, when I tell my story, it's important to highlight that every single one of us who tells our story or who was there at the day or watching on the day indeed had a completely unique experience. So my Hillsborough was being pulled up, being rescued, videoing, because I have a bit of a photographic memory, everything I was seeing and taking in, knowing this was really important that, and how terrible it was. But my friend who I've been split up with on the terraces, their Hillsborough was very different. They knew I was okay. I didn't know they were okay for quite a while. But then, you know, the frustration for people who didn't know what was happening or couldn't see other things that were going on, that was just a different Hillsborough. So I think one of the reasons it's important for those of us who were there need to tell our story when we feel safe and comfortable to do so is because even to this day, when you tell the story, you're still making sense of it and making meaning of it and putting the pieces together. And so that was really my story in terms of getting there, being there, and then leaving the ground. So the ground eventually, where I was, people dissipated, left if they were able to. And I remember the way I left the ground was the same way as I'd kind of come in, as in I waited around. I eventually jumped back down onto the terraces, and then me and my friend were reunited and we went back out the tunnel the way we'd come in. And when we got outside the turnstiles, I remember the friend that we'd arranged to meet when we met him at the railway station was there. And as with some other images that stick in my mind, I'll never forget the look on that person's face. And then just a couple of other sort of random memories that always stick in my mind as well. I now train people to think about responding to disasters. And I always say that, you know, we often rehearse having a terrible disaster in order to rehearse how we save people, the emergency services and others. But when it's really real, like Hillsborough was, this is impossible to put into a pretend disaster or an exercise. And when you actually see an experience on people's faces as well as what they're doing, you know, the look of trauma, it never really leaves you. And the image for me that sums that up is, and anyone who's been to football will get this, you know, when part of going to football, of course, is always not just what happens on the pitch, but getting there and then leaving and being part of a crowd that's walking past the chippy and going home. Well, of course, on that day, there was no noise. It was kind of like, I describe it walking back up a hill, we just followed other people. It was like a great big grey worm, a silent worm of people in silence walking up this hill, and we just followed other people. Obviously we were in shock, and we got onto a bus which took us back to the station and eventually away from Sheffield. And I'll never forget, there was a police officer standing next to the bus helping people get on the bus, and he was very kind, and he helped me get on the bus, didn't say anything, but again the look on that officer's face has never left me. And it was a kind of mixture of extreme shock and compassion and kind of helplessness as well. And I remember that too, because it also was a way of me realizing, although I had seen stuff I won't go into, I knew it was a terrible tragedy and that people had died, but the look on that police officer's face, and regardless of whatever else you might think of the police, you know, you expect them to be in command and control of everything. And that poor point, and it always reminds me that, of course, so many people, we can talk about the us and them, but were victims that day, you know, who did their very best, who tried and wanted to help. So I've often thought about the impact on people like that, as well as the young St. John Ambulance kids and stuff like that. But yeah, those are some key points really for me that stick out from the afternoon. And that was, of course, only the beginning of the disaster.
Absolutely. I mean, it's always been of my contention. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I presume where it comes from in that concept of compartmentalising. I don't know, banks of football supporters, or be it the police or the NHS or whatever it is, the compartmentalisation of clusters of people, basically, and brandishing them and branding them all as one category. You know, and you know, everything you said there kind of like ticks boxes for me in that kind of individual to individual, and we, you know, you've spoken of it, Hillsborough being, and it's not just Hillsborough, it's every kind of, I don't know, facet of life, is that the individual take of a person counts for so much more than, I don't know, a perceived, you know, projection of what we say a full collective will represent or think or feel. There's good and bad and indifferent in every single, you know, collective, basically. And that reinforces everything you said there, just totally reinforces everything that I view and hold dear, really. Your experiences come away from the ground. I mean, I remember that eeriness, that, I don't know, it wasn't what you would expect, you know, to the surroundings to be walking away from something like that. No hysteria. It's the shock, and the people sat. People sat at the roadside is you know, up against brick walls and things like that is everything that I remember. A contemplative nature to the scene, basically. As you're coming away from Sheffield, and you know, how did you cope in the hours afterwards in getting back to Liverpool? It's home. It's, you know, it's home to you as much as it is to me. You know, I've said before, you know, you can be from Liverpool and not of Liverpool. You can be, you know, not from Liverpool but of Liverpool. It's just one of those places that absorbs you or it doesn't. Getting home, you know, and those hours afterwards.
Well, there's a few things that stick out for me, actually. Well, one was we didn't go straight home because we'd already arranged to stay with my friend's family who were from Chesterfield. So we didn't actually go back to Liverpool till the next day. And again, none of our friends realised that. So, you know, many people didn't know that we were okay, who knew we'd gone to the match even till the next day. And that was another part of the ripple impact, which I might come back to. But on the afternoon stroke evening itself, well, I remember coming away, I remember being at Sheffield Station, and there'll be certain people listening to this who won't know what I'm talking about, but there was a big red thing called a telephone box. And that was the only way in those days, there were no mobile phones, to call anyone. And I remember seeing, again, a big queue of people lining up to wait to make a telephone call. And I remember just looking away and thinking, no, too difficult box, and just walked away. And I think what was probably in my mind was to ring home to my mum, who was in London, who, unbeknownst to me, had happened to have the television on and had started worrying and ringing the telephone numbers on the television and all of that from an early time. But I didn't know that. And I think it was too difficult, one, because you just have this instinct to keep moving, to keep carrying on. Secondly, there was a big queue and I probably couldn't be bothered waiting for that. And thirdly, I think unconsciously, I knew my mum would be desperately anxious, and I just couldn't go there. And I say that, Stephen, because in case anyone else experiences this with Hillsborough or anything else, you know, survivor guilt, I often say, is for me and for many people, was the biggest and the hardest thing that I still live with to this day. It's a non-rational thing, but it's so powerful. And I did eventually ring my mum, but it was about 8 o'clock at night. We'd gone to my friend's family home, and I remember we then left and went to the pub, and yeah, we were so deeply in shock. And I rang my mum from a pub phone box, and I think it was a pretty short message. I just said, just letting you know I'm okay. And I never got over the guilt, really, of those 3 hours or so that she lost, more than 3 hours. And do you know what? She never got over that disaster time when minutes and hours seem like days and decades. We did talk about it a lot eventually years later. But so then we stayed away from Liverpool overnight because that had been the plan, and we didn't actually get back to the city the next day. And again, for me, this is very powerful emotions, because I know, and this was why going back to Liverpool and then returning to Liverpool, I left Liverpool a few months later for my first job, and it was actually on the other side of the world in the Far East, and this desperation to get home to Liverpool, just as I'd had the day after the disaster. In fact, I wanted to go back that night. We all want to go home when we feel unsafe or insecure. It was such a powerful thing. So when we did get back home, we got back actually to Liverpool, and I don't know how we knew about this, but we walked up Brownlow Hill, as some will know, and we just instinctively went into the Catholic Cathedral, where they had a kind of vigil, a memorial mass, this was a huge part. The churches were huge. My PhD had actually been on looking at religion in Liverpool, but the churches were huge in helping people have some sense of ritual, place of solace, coming together. So we came straight back and went into that 5 p.m. vigil that they had at the Catholic Cathedral, and then went back home. I had a flat in South Liverpool. And when we got back to the flat, again, we had a telephone with answering phone in those days. And the phone just kept ringing. And every time I put the phone down, somebody else would ring. And they were all saying things like, thank God you're okay. Thank God you're okay. And again, that's very stressful as a memory because, you know, we weren't okay. We were completely in shock. And again, this feeling of just needing to get out of there, get away, was as much as wanting to be home was there. And we actually had tickets to go and see a band called Fairground Attraction.
Oh, I know.
We were playing, I think, in the Empire that night. I think it was the Empire. And I'm pretty sure it was the Empire. And we went out to that concert. Oh, my God. These are all centrifugal moments. It's like you're spinning in your head. And I just remember the lead singer, Eddie Reader, saying during the concert, which I cried all the way through, by the way, saying how shocked they all were by what had happened. And they said, she said in her strong Scottish accent, I wish we could put our arms around you. And, you know, that again is relevant to understanding how it is for anyone who's been through this kind of collective trauma. You feel so vulnerable and helpless. And when people are kind, whether it's during a trauma or in the hours or days or weeks or years later, it matters so much. And so that concert was very special. And then obviously seeing friends again in the days after. A lot of our mates were Liverpool, either Liverpool fans or Evertonians. And so meeting up with them, they'd had their own trauma that afternoon. You know, it was special reunifications, but a lot of it was unspoken. You know, most of my mates were blokes and, you know, they'd kind of take the mickey out of you or say, glad you're okay. And that was it really. And everybody sort of eventually put a lid on it, which we might come back to. But the streets around Liverpool, those first few days and weeks indeed, as you and others may remember, were about being held by the community. Red and blue flowers in all the shops and the scarves around the, you know, the park, and people coming together and going to Anfield where a million people came. All of that helped you to get through those first days, particularly when, and again, we can talk about this if you wish, but then there were extreme reactions of people being so lovely and supportive, even other football fans sending flowers. And then obviously other people started to blame us. So it was absolutely a spinning of a head time in terms of shock and it being surreal. But being held by people really mattered those first days and weeks. And it's something I now train other people about the importance of about being with people after trauma. Just acts of kindness. It's life-saving at that point.
It is. I mean, I remember the warmth. Is the only way I could describe it. And you didn't even have to say anything sometimes. You know, as you say, it was what was unsaid was as powerful as what was said. You know, if anything, more powerful, because like you say, you know, what can you say to people at that point in time? You know, I can remember incidents and occasions where people were kind of like, you know, making each other laugh and stuff like that. And the guilt felt in trying to feel better, you know, a stunning kind of powerful, you know, event like that. You know, I can always hark back. The only thing I can remember being very similar to it was when my grandma died, my dad's mum died in the 1990s. It was on the very same day, my dad's best friend, his youngest son, father of about five children, I think it was three daughters and two sons, or maybe even six children. And his youngest son died in a car crash. And he seemed fine when he got out of the car, and it was internal injuries, you know, he eventually died from. And this had happened on the Wednesday or the Thursday. And we were sat in a pub on a Saturday afternoon. And we were sat not knowing what to be able to say to each other. But then we just started to come out with the stories of you know, the people that we'd just lost. And being the people we were, it would always turn to kind of like the funniest of stories. So the fact that we were just sat there in the corner of a pub laughing for all we were worth, you know, within 48, 72 hours of losing important people of our lives. And people were walking into the pub and not realizing, thinking, how can you be sat there laughing? Because they knew, you know, what had happened. But the more that they kind of like eavesdropped, the more they understood. And it's a strange thing, you know, trauma, grief, you know, despair, whatever you want to call it, it's reaching those little, and we used the word earlier on, I can't remember if we used it before we started recording, that safe safe spots and feeling safe and reaching those. And that struck me in your description of walking away from the ground and walking past that telephone box. It's reaching where you felt safe.
Yeah.
And then moving on to the next safe spot. And that's the only way that you can deal from my perspective in situations like this.
Oh gosh, absolutely. And actually, I think it helps to explain, Stephen, why so powerfully for me and others in the days and weeks after Hillsborough and still to this day, although I moved away eventually from Liverpool before coming back to reunite with other people who are Hillsborough survivors, but being with people who get it. And sometimes it's people who are there. Sometimes it's people who just get it just because they're just that kind of person. But the very, very strong instinct. And in fact, I could put my research head on now because we know that after traumatic experiences, one of the most significant things that makes a difference to people positively is social support. I mean, you don't need research to tell you that if you've been through it, but actually being with other people. And I'll tell you another anecdote, actually, because I remember when Liverpool replayed the game. If you remember, there was lots of debate about when and if the match would be replayed. Eventually, they did replay it. And I couldn't go because we had another family do, and I was press ganged into going to that. And I couldn't explain to my dear family, it's not always the people closest to you, the people who love you the most, who don't get it. But, it was important that I attend this family thing. So I did go. But I remember the rip of not being with everybody else when they re-came together for that match. And every single match after that for the rest of that season, as you may remember as well, and I guess this could apply to other matches, when there's so much layering of meaning onto a match or a tournament or a period of time, every match mattered. Every match mattered. And for me, football is always about more than just the result anyway. But in that season, those encounters, which was also about coming together with those who were there or who get it or who understand. The strength in numbers and being with other people is really important. And I found myself intuitively, instinctively wanting to be with others who were either from Hillsborough or later on, actually, I met people from other disasters. I sought them out and joined a little charity, which sounds a morose group of people, but we were all people who'd been through disasters of the 1980s, and we came together and formed a charity called Disaster Action. And we helped to bring about some change in the law and things like that. But at the end of the day, every time we would come together, even though we'd been through very different disasters like Lockerbie, Marchioness, King's Cross fire, Clapham, we never had to talk about our experiences. We would just get in a room and we would just, like you said, we didn't have to say anything, but we just got it. And that's where I got my support in the days after Hillsborough.
Within this, I mean, difficult to cast across the range of emotions. Anger plays a part in this and recovery, and it's a natural thing. How angry did you get?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I'll preface it by saying that how you deal with any of these things, I'm objectifying it rather than saying but I'm actually talking about myself. I think how any of us deal with stuff like something so extreme as this is partly a reflection of the kind of person you were before. And that's relevant because I've never been good at dealing with anger. I'm still not to this day. I tend to bottle it. I tend to swallow it. That's probably why I have a history of depression, which made me extra vulnerable in terms of the impact of Hillsborough. And by the way, I had an unresolved bereavement. My dad had died very suddenly and unexpectedly some years before Hillsborough when I was 17. All of that played into how I dealt with Hillsborough and after. And I didn't see the connection at the time, but now I completely get it. So I was the sort of person that wasn't good at dealing with anger. And one of the things that I think helped and hindered at the same time, actually, dealing with the anger, what helped was that obviously we knew, I say obviously, those of us who were there, although we were in shock, we knew absolutely what had happened. And when we started to tell our stories to each other, there was that collective understanding that was very different from the narrative that was starting to be peddled. And that made us angry. And so there was a helpful thing in being able to be angry with other people. The hindrance was, and I say this over the years and years later too, is that sometimes the anger can take you down and it can polarise, going back to what we said before about the us and them, and help you not to see things very clearly, even when you see other things extremely clearly and correctly. So anger is a very mixed bag. It's a necessary thing. I think I channel my anger into trying to be active a couple of ways. I joined what Rogan Taylor had started after high school, I think, which was the Football Supporters Association, which was, you know, first of all, countering ID cards. That will get me angry if we talk about that. And the anger against the government and things like that was very much going on. So I channeled it into that kind of thing. And then I guess the way I really ultimately resolved my anger, which was a reflection of the person I was I just got academic about everything. I started gathering all the reports, all the newspaper cuttings, which I have to this day. I wrote a chronology, a timeline of every single, I looked at all the newspapers and started putting a timeline of everything that happened on the first days, weeks, months. I still got it. And I've published some papers years later, again, part of making sense and meaning. So I just started getting the facts and all of that and keeping it all. And then eventually, many, many years later, I ended up thinking, well, you know, social scientists, sociologists should be looking at these kind of events, not just Hillsborough. And it didn't happen straight away. But eventually, I ended up changing my career to try and channel that anger into change in education and campaigning for changes in the law around accountability and stuff like that, and then teaching people who went on to try and plan and respond to other disasters. So I guess, in short, my way of dealing with anger is wasn't very good at dealing with stuff emotionally, and that's not a good thing. But I did go sort of academic and went into the campaigning and joining groups and things like that. But there was a cost to not dealing with that anger, which I think is relevant if I was talking to my younger self again, or anyone else who identifies with this. Because you see, by not dealing with the anger, what I did was swallow it, like I had with my losing my dad. And so I just carried on, got on with life. I did talk about it a lot at the beginning. And I used to do a lot of interviews when I started working with Disaster Action, and people would say, is there a survivor from Hillsborough and things like that. And then I stopped talking about it because people just didn't get it. And as you'll know, Stephen, you know, over the decades then, people still didn't believe us. People were still, you know, doing these hate chants and things like that. And so I just stopped talking about it. And that is the worst way to deal with anger or depression and stuff like that. And so I went in and out of depression, which was to do with Hillsborough and also the trauma of that, and also to do with not dealing with, you know, my dad's loss and things like that. And so the message I would say to anyone else is realize that there is anger. It's necessary anger, and hopefully get opportunities to share the anger in the right kind of environment for you and maybe for other people if you can channel it.
Absolutely. You know, from my experience, I could only, you know, agree with so much you've said there. You know, a lot of us have felt over the years that we've kind of self-desensitized ourselves, but within that, all we've done is put extra layers upon ourselves. And that central core, you know, is still the same as it was that day. You know, we're just trying to move, you know, I don't know, protect ourselves in that respect. And it's, again, with experience in passing years, it's kind of like, it's only later that you come to question, was that the correct way of doing it? But it was maybe not in the long term, but it was for that point in time. But, you know, within that, I think so many of us never changed. And that's why for me, kind of like an unseasonably sunny day, you know, in mid-April would not be, and I'd never understand why. All of the aesthetics that would often kind of like, you know, give me a kick, and it took a long time to realise why that was the case. Now, where you are, you know, now, Anne, you know, and the positives that have come from it. I mean, it's great hearing about, you know, you talk about anger there and channeling in positives as well. You know, I always feel guilty mentioning this, and I said that the positives, we talked about the positives last time I saw you. You know, the people that I've met because of the Hillsborough disaster that might have not been in my life had it, you know, had life, had the 15th of April gone another way, had we played at Villa Park that day instead of at Hillsborough, you know, had we slipped up at home to Brentford, you know, in the quarterfinals. The positives that you take from, you know, the last 35 years.
Yeah, I think it's worth actually saying, first of all, that is it okay to have some positives? Because you see, the survivor guilt is shouting at me in my head, but I've recognised that shouting for many years now. And I just, you know, it can never be said too many times. It's okay to have some things positive that come out of such a terrible experience when so many people died and that our lives were changed forever. That doesn't make you responsible for what happened, and it doesn't make it okay that it happened, but it did happen. And so with that in place, yeah, there have been positives. I mean, I still have a massively special connection and bond to Liverpool and to the football and to every time. And this is part of why, you know, having met you only recently, I feel like I've known you all my life, Steve. And I have these people in my life who I call Hillsborough mates, and I meet them thankfully through work. And sometimes, and some people may not get this, but sometimes they're people who've even, I've actually through my work had this bizarre experience of meeting people who are literally on the other side of the fence on that day, including police officers who, you know, I realise have been through just as great a hell. It's a different hell, but from being blamed and exonerated and blamed and exonerated over the years as me. And but that's quite bewildering sometimes because it challenges the us and them kind of reaction. But so the positives, yeah, eventually I just started. I left Liverpool for work a few months after, and then I was desperate to come back to Liverpool. And 2 years later, I got a job lecturing again, but back in Liverpool. So I came home, as I would say, to Liverpool for another few years before I left again for work. And eventually all these papers and the reports, not least of what was happening with the Hillsborough story over the years, I gathered them all. And then I one day said to my sister-in-law, all I want to do now is teach and research about disasters. I was teaching in a theology department at the time, can you believe it? But I was collecting all these reports. And then a month later, a job came up teaching disaster management, which was quite a new degree at the time. It was a bit of a punt. I went for it. It was in an engineering department, and I'm a social scientist. But to their credit, the people running the course gave me the chance to be a course leader, talking about the people part, really, the psychological and the social part of disasters. So suddenly for 5 years, full time, I was able to teach disaster management. The people that I was teaching, and now I work independently, I've done that for 20 years after leaving the university. The positive for me, and hopefully for others, is that now I can teach and research and help to educate and support people to understand the impact of disaster, to prepare, to respond to them. I teach people, you know, senior people who are part of what you'd now call Gold Command or, you know, running incidents. And it is very positive because compared to 35 years ago, there are better plans in place. There's still more to do. And I have found there is a cultural change. And obviously the stuff around the Hillsborough law and the duty of candor is part of that. And I work with many people who really, really want to do the right thing, just as there were on that day. And that for me is a positive. The other massive positive for me is a few years ago, and I thought I was over quite a lot of this because I'd had loads and loads of counselling and therapy over the years, some good, some absolutely awful because they didn't get about trauma and Hillsborough. But then I came across the Hillsborough Survivor Support Alliance. And I, out of curiosity, I dropped an email to Peter and Diane who run it. And I went to my first meeting. And again, like when I met people in disaster action from other disasters 30 years ago, when I met people, which was at Anfield, who were all other survivors, and it was over 30 years later, it was again like coming home. And although I don't get to all the physical meetings now, that is my Hillsborough mates, really. We have a WhatsApp group, and I'm quite quiet on it most of the time, but reading the messages for some people who are hearing this for the first time and wondering whether to tell their story or to open that box, it's massive. It's very painful. It's very hard, but that's what keeps people like me going, and I hope that's positive for other people. So that's been a massive positive thing. And then seeing other people, a new generation, want to learn and understand about Hillsborough, now the truth has been acknowledged, all of that is positive. And at the end of the day, of course, Liverpool being on the top again and doing well this season, and Klopp and all the layers of meaning to another loss. But all of that is a positive because, you know, Liverpool FC and the city kind of feels like it runs through my blood. And Hillsborough is a big part of that, but it's not the only part. And that's a positive, as well as meeting people like you, of course.
And the same for me as well, Anne. Everything that you said there, you know, being a product of Liverpool. I always decide I was a product of Liverpool rather than, you know, from Liverpool. My parents moved out when I was a kid. You know, I did a lot of my growing up in the hills of Lancashire, basically. And we were always called the Woolies when we were going back for family parties and stuff like that. But yeah, and I can always remember that. But the warmth of which it was said, and that's why, you know, for me, it's always, I use that phrase early on, you can be from Liverpool but not of Liverpool. You know, you can be, you know, of Liverpool but not from Liverpool, and you can be everything in between, and it's just
oh yes. And do you know what, sorry interrupting, but this kind of asked me, it's going to sound a bit bizarre, but it's a positive. I remember in the week after Hillsborough, when people were talking and being so kind and supportive, and you may remember, you know, that some of those who died at Hillsborough were female, and some of them were from, not from Liverpool, as I wasn't at the time. And I'd always had a little bit of me when I was on the cot, because I am a girl, or was a girl, and I was from London. I didn't have a Liverpool accent, I don't. But, you know, there was this really strange sense of being accepted in the most horrific of times, because even though I was a girl, even though I wasn't from Liverpool, you know, that wrapping round of the arms of everybody who was affected by Hillsborough, and roll forward 35 years, because people like me couldn't even... I was accused of being Charlie George when I played football on a field in North London in the 70s because I had long blonde hair. But, you know, nowadays girls can play football and, you know, girls and women go to the match, and all of that, you know, has changed positively. But it does remind me of how feeling accepted and being of Liverpool, even though I wasn't of the city or a boy or with the right accent, all of that was one of the things that struck me very much of being accepted after Hillsborough, strange as it sounds. And that's a positive very much today.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, and then go into the Jurgen Klopp theme, you know, there's a living embodiment of being of Liverpool and not from Liverpool. We always like it when someone gets us. And that's the way I've always, you know. And it's a terrible phrase. I think it's you know, it's being used a lot nowadays, but, you know, someone who gets us and stuff like that. But, yeah, there's a bit of truth in that. There's very much a bit of truth in that. And it's been an absolute joy to spend three quarters of an hour talking to you. And we need to have you on for another topic at some point that we can rejoice in.
Thanks for what you're doing, Stephen. I'm sure I'm not the only one who feels this. But, yeah, it's always lovely to talk with you, and especially on topics to do with football.
Oh, brilliant. My friend, my great friend, Dr. Anna, thank you so much. All that leaves me to say is thank you for listening. Please do join us again for another Hillsborough conversation very soon. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.